So this week, Center for Sustainable Development is hosting Professor Cory Dolgon. Let me introduce Professor first. Professor Cory Dolgon is an expert in several areas of sociology and service learning. He authored 5 books, including the current one on American fascism. He has also written numerous articles and book reviews. Professor Dolgon is also the past president of the Society for the Study of Social Problems and the past president of the Association for Humanist Sociology. He also served as past editor of Humanity and Society, and he sits on the editorial boards of Social Problems, Critical Sociology, Teaching Sociology, and Theory and Action. Cory, I would like to start with a question about the sociology. What inspired you to pursue a career in sociology?
Well, I once wrote a short piece called The Accidental Sociologist. and so I don't know that it was my intention. I began in college with an interest in politics, and particularly Marxism. And when I took my first sociology class, I was able to piece together a lot of different ideas and some activism that I was doing. And also, I was interested in music, and I was playing the guitar, mostly learning at the time, and just found I could combine a lot of my interests in what was then a sociology and English degree. But I really found my interdisciplinarity, as we sometimes say in English, unfortunately, but my interest in different disciplines to come together in American studies. And at the time, I got a master's degree in American studies and was looking more and more at the role of music in politics. And ended up getting my doctorate in American culture at the University of Michigan. But most of the people on my committee were sociologists. Mm-hmm. And so when I started looking for jobs, it just seemed like sociology was a much better field than American studies for jobs. And I was also becoming more interested in global issues. And so I became a sociologist because I got a job as a sociologist. but I think that over the years, I've had a kind of love-hate relationship with it. And so I really love the origins of sociology as an engaged and activist discipline that studies the problems of the world with the understanding that we need to change them. And so, you know, the famous epitaph on Marx's grave in England, you know, the philosophers have only interpreted the world. The goal is to change it. So I think that's really what inspired me about sociology. And the hate part of the relationship is I feel that students come to sociology often in graduate school, but sometimes as undergraduates too, because they think that sociology is this place where they can do it. And I think the goal of sociologists has to be to cultivate that and not quiet it.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I would like to ask now about the concept that is very difficult to explain, about the concept of community, because you have written extensively on this concept. How do you define community in the context of your research?
Sure. So I'll take a step back and then get into it. But I would say that what has always kept me connected, I won't say grounded, but connected to sociology is my interest in engaging in the problems of the people around me. And so while I've been somewhat nomadic in my life and have moved a number of times, my goal is to find groups of people in the areas that I live in who are working to change different things and different issues. And I always see part of my role is to try and help people connect issues to make the groups and the community stronger. So for me, community is a way of talking about how we engage and create social relationships with other people. And while historically I think it's always been sometimes a provincial term, sometimes thinking about communities as simply place-based groups of people, often kind of identity-driven by whether it's religion or race, ethnicity, etc. For me, communities are also purposeful connections that we make. And I wrote an article years ago about communities of commitment, the idea that we build new communities based on what we're committed to, not just who we are or what identities we've had. It seems to me that's the theoretical hope of the future, that we recognize that our goals to live productive, meaningful, loving lives as human beings is what ought to bring us together as a larger world as opposed to a small, you know, kind of Durkheimian mechanical solidarity-based community. That was a little sociology joke for those of you who get that. But I do think that for me, community is much more of that purposeful coming together to make change than it is the kind of traditional sense of just people in one place who believe in certain things together.
I like the definition. It brings hope. Your research often engages with issues of power and inequality. How do you see the role of sociology in challenging these structures? And what are some effective strategies for promoting social change?
Yeah, those are all good questions. You get an A today for questions. Well, there are sociology. There's an old adage in American journalism that the purpose of journalism was to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And I find that works for me with sociology, that our goal ought to be to produce the knowledge that will help people who are struggling for dignity, equality, survival, and that we also have the role of critiquing power. And I think that sociologists have actually had a long history of being very good at critiquing power, understanding how power works, coming up with theories and methods to study power. I think we've been much less effective in working to change those dynamics of power. And so, you know, most of the early sociologists were really engaged in thinking about either, you know, policy making, like Durkheim or Weber, Durkheim especially in education, and then Marx, of course, in this kind of revolutionary idea of class-based solidarity. But I think sociology has become professionalized like so many other disciplines. And so in our move to publish and our move to teach a kind of formalized curriculum and all the other things that have determined what higher education is and therefore what disciplines are, I think we've lost a lot of that connection to how sociology can help develop visions for change. And so I think that the best way to get back to those kinds of roots are to get back to those people who are in struggle. And the more we can develop relationships and work with people in struggle, and as I'll say today in the workshop, to work collaboratively, collectively, democratically, with a focus on the relationships more than the methods, I think we can bring sociology back to its roots.
Mm-hmm. So it's like time for a small revolution in sociology. You are known for engaging and often unconventional teaching methods. What are some of the key principles that guide your pedagogy, and how do you encourage critical thinking in your students?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, and I don't know how different students are in Poland than in the U.S., but I find that students you know, students are no different than other people in the community, that when you kind of build a relationship, you find that they have their own theory. They have their own critical thinking about certain things. And so students have critical thinking as well. It's just not that they've been encouraged to use that critical sense that they already have to think about changing structures. Most of their critical awareness has to do with protecting themselves from a world that is both overwhelming as well as infringing on their time and their space and their pleasure and their joy. And as we, those of us who are over 30, we might criticize what they choose as their source of pleasure and joy. But I find that if I can develop at least a general sense of a social relationship with the students, and so, you know, I try to build the curriculum based on what they choose, on what they want to study, particularly in an intro course to sociology. I try to give them opportunities to do group work, work together. We do a lot of small group work in the classroom, which I think encourages them to build relationships among themselves. To me, that's the essence of what sociology can do. And, you know, the concepts, the theories, all of the different parts of the curriculum that all of the different organizations for professional sociologists encourage us to do, I find they can be done in a way that doesn't numb them to sociology as something that's engaged with the real world, as opposed to something that they have to read about in books and then write about in their, you know, on their exams. So I do try to do a lot of different kinds of things. I've been using more theater games from Gusto Boal, and we'll do some of that today too in the workshop. And I have, you know, my singing lecture, which is, you know, when done well, is a completely participatory and engaging way to talk about music and politics.
Yeah, you're famous for your singing lectures.
Well, famous. Yeah.
I would like to welcome you now to give us an example.
Sure, sure. So I'm going to sing a song that was very popular. Sorry about this. You should never do this on radio. This is a song that comes out of the civil rights movement, and singing became a really important part of the civil rights movement because of the role that it played for direct action. And so, long history of politics and music and people writing songs about struggles, certainly descriptive songs, sometimes educational songs. And tomorrow in the lecture, I'll talk about all of this. But to me, one of the most important things that songs do is it helps people come together, and it helps them as they're actually participating in the struggle itself. So in the civil rights movement, there were many, many songs that were written and adapted to the demonstrations, to the idea of marching, to the idea of boycotts and sit-downs and other forms of direct action that were used during that movement. And quite often, these songs were based on old religious songs, gospel songs. In the United States, the history of the Black Church was a real important resource for organizing against racism and segregation. And so a lot of these songs were originally gospel songs and then were turned into civil rights songs, which would be a lecture in itself. But this is a really favorite of the Freedom Singers, which was one of the most popular groups during the civil rights movement. And again, it's an old gospel song changed to a civil rights song.
Well, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed
on freedom. Yes, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Yes, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Well, I've been walking, talking with my mind stayed on freedom. I've been walking and talking with my mind stayed on freedom. I've been walking and talking with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Well, there's nothing wrong to have your mind stayed on freedom. No, there's nothing wrong with your mind stayed on freedom. No, there's nothing wrong to have your mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Thank you so much, Corey. It was lovely. Oh, I should start singing during lectures.
Yes, yes. No, yeah. Students love it. I've been doing it for 25 years now, and it never fails that people will have me come to do these lectures, and as soon as I show up, they start apologizing. I just want you to know, I don't think the students will really participate that much. They probably won't sing very much. Knock on wood, it never fails that students sing. And anyone who comes to these, sometimes it's more, we would say, pulling teeth. Sometimes it's more difficult. But in the end, students are singing and they're clapping and they're standing. And that level of participation, to me, is an object lesson in activism. And that we don't expect that most people will become active, even if it's an important struggle that they're suffering from, but they will. And they just need sometimes the organizing capacity, sometimes the inspiration, and sometimes they just need a song.
I have a very important question for you. Yeah. In your opinion, what is the role of the university in fostering social justice and civic engagement?
I would say it's the only role. And I know that not everyone agrees. From a political, from a human role, if the university is about progress, the question is always progress towards what? And if the progress is about a better world, a more humane world, a world that has less suffering, right, and more opportunities for authenticity, creativity, joy, love, then that's what the university ought to be about. Nowadays, universities will talk a language of excellence. They'll talk the language of innovation. And they'll use the word progress. But generally, it's a progress that's dominated by neoliberalism when it's not dominated by fascism. But that's a whole other question. But I do think that even the neoliberal university has been focused primarily on economic development. Even if we go back to the idea of just universities as knowledge producers, the question has always been knowledge for what and knowledge for whom. And I think that for too long, universities have been driven by what's become a kind of bureaucratic neoliberal sensibility about what it means to be excellent and what it means to be innovative. And I think I would just like to suggest that there's nothing wrong with the idea that the universities ought to be about progress. And in fact, you know, go back to Thomas Kuhn and the ideas of revolution, you know, scientific revolution. Yeah, I think the universities ought to be about revolution. It's just the question of for what.
Thank you so much. We know that your work extends beyond academia into direct community engagement. And could you share some examples of your involvement and the impact you have seen?
Sure. And I should say that I don't think there's one way to do this. I think there are many ways. You know, today we'll talk about building relationships as a foundation for that work. That I think the best kinds of engaged research that we do are emergent methodologically. We come with a toolkit of various methods, and that can be useful. But we need to be prepared to expand the toolkit, you know, to use things together that we may not have thought went together. And the more collective and collaborative our research is with people in communities, the more that methodology evolves to fit the work. And so the projects have to really shape the methodology. I don't think our methodology should shape the project. As far as, you know, things that I've done, some of my favorite projects, one started in graduate school when I was doing my degree. I hadn't really thought too much about these things, but I knew that I was engaged with different groups, and we were reading Stuart Hall and work from the Cultural Studies Center in England. And I was noticing so much of the early work from the center was engaged with the politics of London, particularly anti-racism and class work, class-based work. But by the time the center was producing a lot of literature and theory, that work was not as focused. So as a graduate student, you know, a number of us looked around at different political issues in the community and decided to work with the Homeless Action Committee. And that work really shaped my early thinking about how to do cultural studies work, because the group was already, you know, there were formerly homeless people, there were community activists, there were graduate students, because the University of Michigan is, you know, dominates the city. And coming from different disciplines, and really we took on different kinds of projects that came up because of what was happening around us. So we knew we needed more low-income housing because there was a growing homeless population. And in order to get the resources to develop low-income housing, we had to look at the county and the city budgets, and we had to look at the policies that were being made. And so much of the local history then informed us, and particularly the history of people who were homeless, who taught us about the history of gentrification and displacement. And how the Black community in Ann Arbor had been dispersed to the outskirts of the city by some of the gentrification that was driven by the university itself. And so, you know, we produced everything from a walking tour that looked at the displacement of low-income housing. We did a tent city, in particular about the use of city money to build office buildings instead of low-income housing. We took over a parking lot that was that was supposed to become a six-story parking lot instead of the kind of ground level lot it was at the time. And because there were two houses that had been condemned to level in order to build that, we occupied those houses. And eventually, we got the city to take the money out of that project so it wasn't funded. And we also had the city relocate those houses and rehab them in order to be low-income housing. And so, you know, we were responsible for about 10 new units of low-income housing, which was obviously more symbolic, except for the, you know, 15 or 20 people who lived there. But I think that proved to me that we could use develop our ideas about sociology and research by doing this work in the field. And so, you know, we were somewhat successful in what we did. But even to go back to that city now, some 35 years later, the impact of that movement is still there. There's a very large low-income housing development nonprofit that is still in existence and very strong. The tenants' rights movement in the city is still very strong, and partly it's because it's connected to the university. But again, that's what universities ought to be about, right? So that I feel like that was very formative for me. And since then, I've been very lucky to be parts of local organizations, whether it was workers who were outsourced to management companies where we were able to fight back, not only get them their jobs back, but my first book on the Hamptons in New York is really comes out of that struggle because it was the custodial workers there who taught me that it wasn't just a kind of corporatization of the academy mindset, which I thought, you know, everybody's outsourcing, everybody's privatizing all around the country. But they said, well, it's really about racism. And what they taught me was that, in fact, there was a long history of racism and segregation, even on Long Island in New York, that I just didn't know about. And so I really had to kind of reconceptualize my thinking about how race and class came together. And, you know, I was already a professor and really learning some of the most important lessons that I had to learn from the custodians.
Thank you so much. We talked briefly about theories when we were walking here. How do you navigate the challenges of bridging the gap between academic theory and community-based activism? Must be difficult.
Well, it's only difficult if I kind of reify, right? If I turn these theories into objects, if I turn the theories into whole things that you know, that aren't fluid and that aren't kind of in the process of always being theorized, right? I think I wrote a piece. Now I'm old, so I forget even what I've written. But that the revolution would not be theorized, right? And so, you know, I love talking about theory. I think it's fun. It's what, you know, we do, right? It's like guitar players like to talk about guitars, you know? So certainly there's a language of that among professional academics and particularly sociologists. And I think that there are a lot of incredible ideas that I love talking to students about. But I want to convince them that, you know, theories are ideas to be mixed and matched. They're not to be purified. Mm-hmm. And they're not to be, you know, there's nothing worse than a career spent arguing the minute points of, you know, Weberian sociology. I think that it's fun to do that over a beer. And sometimes it's fun in the classroom if everybody's read the same piece and talk about it and wants to talk about it. But, you know, Weber was wrong about a lot of stuff. You know, some of the most important conversations he ever had were with W.E.B. Du Bois. And Du Bois taught Weber a lot about race. I think some of the best things about Weber, although he was incredibly smart and had a lot of really great things to say and his work on bureaucracy and other things really important, but he's also smart enough to know that he could still learn. And, you know, some of the things that he had said about his conversations with Du Bois and his ability to learn from Du Bois in some ways also set Weber apart. But Du Bois goes through incredible changes through his lifetime. He leaves the academy in the early 20s because he no longer thinks it's a viable institution to fight against racism, and ends up, you know, becoming one of the first leaders of the NAACP in the U.S., one of the foremost groups fighting against segregation and racism at the time. And by the end, you know, he becomes a communist. There's a fun story about my dad actually taking a class with Du Bois at the Communist Party school in New York City. And becomes a Pan-Africanist and a revolutionary. So, you know, from someone who was a Harvard student, Harvard PhD, and believed that knowledge and research could change the world, he later believes that, you know, no. Research and knowledge production are part of struggles, but the struggles themselves need to be fought as these political battles, mobilizing people, and sociology is more or less a tool for that.
I agree with you. It's more, it's not.
I knew you would.
But in your opinion, what are the most pressing social justice issues that you believe require our immediate attention?
Yeah, immediate. Immediate makes it sound as if there was one, right? Because, you know, and if it's immediate, how can there be more than one? And if there's more than one, aren't we overwhelmed? And I think we are overwhelmed. The obvious ones to me are, you know, fascism and climate change. Mm. And, you know, at first glance, they may seem very different. But I see them as part of kind of the same movement among people who see authoritarianism as the only way to manage a global economy and global culture. And their perception of climate change is incredibly limited. And so, you know, to produce that kind of power, they have to continue to produce the kind of society that continues to be self-destructive climate-wise. But we will not be able to affect the kind of climate change systems, sustainability, green economies, et cetera. We won't be able to establish that until we fight fascism as well. I don't think we fight one and not the other. Well, you know, once we get the anti-fascist stuff in order, then we'll tackle the environment. I think we have to do both. A new book that I have out called Sociology for Social Justice has a piece in it about system change, not climate change. And I think, to me, that's the kind of holistic vision that we're looking for, that we fight for climate change, but it's not just about changing the climate. It's about changing our political and economic systems.
I like it. System
change. Yeah. I know that it's happening in Austria. I think there are other groups around the world that have adopted that kind of motto, and I think it's a really powerful one. So I think those two, but, you know, I mean, fascism is based in many ways on a kind of racialized, racist identity, right? The idea of a pure identity, of a homeland identity, which tends to always be kind of white, often Christian, not solely. As we know, we can watch the State of Israel and see that, you know, Christianity doesn't have a lock on fascism. But I think that, again, you know, the kind of anti-colonialist battle is still in effect, and it's part of the anti-fascist battle. So, you know, I would say those are kind of in the forefront of things, and many other struggles are subsidiary. But, you know, what happens with an idea like fascism? We find, you know, the old ideas of patriarchy are back, right? And so whereas many countries in the world have moved forward on the idea of women's rights, especially reproductive rights, you see in the U.S. we're going backwards. So, you know, once again, we may be number one, only this time in fascism.
It's not a positive conclusion.
No.
But it's true. You mentioned a few of your books, but what are you currently working on? Could you share it with us?
Sure. I have two books that really in the early stages of, although I'm still working on American fascism, and that hasn't been completed yet. And I'm sure the publishers have probably given up on me by now. But that will be written. But one book that I feel needs to get out immediately is I've collected a dozen or so different sociologists to write a book on the first 100 days of the new Trump administration.
Exciting.
It's called Condemn and Resist. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to look at not briefly, kind of would like it to be a short and maybe even accessible book to the general public, not just the sociologists, but to look at an analysis as well as a strategy. And so in a short space of 10 or 12 pages, I'd like to see my colleagues write about immigration, write about higher education, write about some of the economic policy, certainly the anti-democratic strategies of the current administration, and not only kind of detail the analysis, but also to really think about what strategies will work and what should we consider to resist. And the other book I'm writing, which I assume won't be done until 2026, but this is based on my presidential address a few years ago, and it's called Revolutionary Sociology.
I would love to read it when it's done.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to write it. So we'll have a common interest in it getting done.
And then thinking about our students, I would like to ask the last question, actually.
Sure.
What are the books or thinkers that have most shaped your worldview?
Such a good question. I'm definitely, I think Marxism was the first kind of sociological body of work that really spoke to me. Having grown up with a family that were activists and former members of the Communist Party in New York City, when my dad took a class with Du Bois, I think though, as I progress, there's the historian Howard Zinn in the U.S. who actually I took some classes with as an undergrad and was sort of a mentor. My graduate school mentor was Robin D.G. Kelly, who I think is just a brilliant writer and very active public intellectual, not only writing really powerful books on things like rap and jazz music and things of that sort. I think he has a definitive book on Monk, for those of you who are Thelonious Monk, who are jazz musicians or appreciators. But he's written extensively on Black Lives Matter, extensively on Palestine. He travels to different places and is really inspiring, I think. But there's so much great new work that comes out that we don't always see. The group Code Pink produced some great work. Medea Benjamin has written some great books from an activist perspective, but certainly critiquing both gender and heterosexism in the U.S. globally. Really, really smart and really engaged. And I think that's, to me, when I think about what I want my students to read, I really want them to read work that's grounded in a kind of engagement with the world that suggests there is possible solutions. And that's why the singing lecture really lets me not only talk about the social problems that exist and are, situations, sometimes they're always dire, but certainly seem more now than maybe 30 years ago for people who are hungry, powerless, poor, 30 years ago was pretty bad too. But I think using music is also a way to provide a kind of hope and provide a kind of vision that, you know, there's what Freire calls a critical optimism, you know, in the Pedagogy of Hope, which is a great book. And Freire is someone that undergraduates can read, depending on the translations always. I have never read a translation of Freire into Polish, but, you know, I think he's very hopeful. But, you know, he talks about in the Pedagogy of Hope that it's important to have hope, but hope in and of itself is kind of meaningless. Mm-hmm. And we need to have a critical hope, one that understands what the problems are, but recognizes historically people have overcome so many problems. And we need to understand analytically, and for that certainly sociology helps, what the current landscape is in order to understand what we need to do to bring about that hope.
Thank you so much, Corey. Sure. These were all my questions. Auntie, do you want to sing? You don't have to.
No, I'm happy to close out with one more song.
Thank you.
Sure, sure. this is a good song to think about critical hope, as long as I can remember how it goes. This is a song that comes out of the Farmer Labor Organizing Committee in the Midwest. A man by the name of Baldomar Velasquez took a popular song from the 70s and rewrote the lyrics. It was down in Newton Grove where we first came to organize the South. Down in North Carolina, sign cards for the Union boys, one by one and farm by farm, till we get enough to take a stand. A little bit is better than nada. Sometimes you want the whole enchilada. Oh, a little bit is better than nada. A little bit or nothing at all. We went to rent a Legion Hall. We were told to pay twice the price for Mexicans. I said, lady, we'll pay. We're not looking for no handouts, ma'am. We're just workers here to take a stand. And we won't let a little money stand in our way. A little bit's better than nada. Sometimes you want the whole enchilada. Oh, yes, a little bit is better than nada, a little bit or nothing at all. Farmer down in Pink Hill Way beat his workers so bad they had to run away at the break of day. Workers called him the devil man, but the union's here to take a stand with righteous folks, so the devil never has his way. A little bit's better than nada. Sometimes you want the whole enchilada. Oh yes, a little bit is better than nada. A little bit or nothing at all. A little bit or nothing at all. A little bit till we get it all.
Thank you so much, Corey. It was a pleasure talking
Thank
to you.
Thank you so much, Hila.
It's the highest time for brunch.
Ah, excellent.